Okay, and welcome everybody to another Tuesday afternoon on Shake and Wake Radio. I'm Stephen Robertson. This is Cancel the Cabal. And I'm also on PSN Radio, SoFlo Radio, and EPGN Radio. And I do want to mention, before I forget off in the beginning, that all the stations are listener-supported, so please help out if you're able to. I know Annie's going to be moving, so she would really appreciate it. She's already got enough hassles with the internet guy yesterday. Telling her that she was rude or something. Something like that. I can't imagine Andy being rude. But I am going to continue on reading the sexual sabotage. How One Mad Scientist Unleashed a Plague of Corruption and Contagion on America. By Dr. Judith Reisman. I will go back. You're welcome, Andy. You can't be rude. We just started chapter 12 last week. And I want to go back one half paragraph to go over last week's. Nah, Andy would never be rude. Kinsey's sex science frauds claimed widespread sexual promiscuity, spawning the sexual freedom of adultery and an epidemic of divorce that in turn increased child abandonment, child crime, and child victimization. Though I was a child in the big sin city of Los Angeles in 1948, my world was safe and innocent. But the Kinsey lobby soon bred sexual predators by the thousands, eventually by the tens of thousands, justifying and then legalizing their perverted crimes and instilling distrust and fear between men and women. The Kinsey cult ate away at our civility. Our American progenitors had battled black slavery, sex slavery, wage slavery, economic depressions, foreign and domestic wars, and massive waves of immigration, thanks to the common law's Judeo-Christian political and social moral vision. The Protestant work ethic, the 20th century middle class emerged. This culture prized hard work as salvation and stressed the importance of sobriety, both sexual and intoxicant. With this ethic and commitment to God as the bedrock of our national prosperity, America became affluent. In 1932, well before Kinsey burst into the front pages of national and international acclaim, his close friend, French pedophile judge René Guillon, had worked out the legislative strategy in 1932 for abolishing child protections. In fact, Guillon helped craft the legal language for Kinsey, asserted as his own words in both his male and female volumes, brazenly portraying adult sexual abuse of children as natural, as basic as eating or breathing. Guillon argued that chastity was abnormal, but any sex act, anything, was normal. The flyleaf of Guillon's book, Sex Life and Sex Ethics, 1933, said, he proceeds to the discussion of onanism, incest, homosexuality, fetishism, and even such extraordinary variations as necrophilia and coprophilia, all of which he considers to fall within the limits of the normal. This Guillon book was issued in English. Coterminous with Kinsey's male volume, wrapped in the mantle of Kinsey's authority, as he quoted from Kinsey's just published 1948 findings. Once Kinsey proved that it was both commonplace and natural to commit all manner of deviant sexual offenses, the law soon followed suit. Insulating offenders from legal recrimination, rather than protecting women and children from their predation. Kinsey's legal followers saw to it that such attitudes were adopted into American law. Before Kinsey, our laws had come to reflect the delicacy of human emotions, the harm of domestic betrayal, the critical importance of sexual dignity for all people. Enter Kinsey, who himself served in the Illinois Commission on Sex Offenders work group to devise the framework for sexual offender law, blaming the lack of sex education for high levels of sex crimes in the early 1950s. Kinsey and reformers testified tirelessly before state legislators and asserted in professional, academic, and legal literature that sex education would reduce the number of sex crimes and high recidivism rates. Law performers promoted Kinsey's fundamental assertion that human beings are sexual from birth. In the world of law, this came to mean that small children would be provocateurs. For example, Kinsey's colleague, the oft-quoted psychiatrist and law professor Ralph Slavenko, accuses very young victims of seducing their molesters. Recall that he says, even at the age of 4 or 5, seductiveness may be so powerful as to overwhelm the adult into committing the offense. Kinsey supported other researchers we now know to be pedophiles and pederasts. Indeed, Lloyd DeMuse, PhD, editor of Journal of Psychohistory, reports that most sex researchers shared most sex researchers shared and still share Kinsey's legal certifiable sexual pathologies. Like Kinsey, they used science to legitimize and legalize their own pathologies, to increase acceptance among mental health professionals, and to promote the idea that sexual abuse was harmless for children, for child and adult. Redefining children as sexual, implicitly capable of consent, soon dramatically increased plea bargains reduced down to non-sex crimes, non-felonies. This had the unanticipated result of lowering sex crime rates by reclassification, reducing penalties for child molestation and rape to allow paroles and pardons even for repeat sexual predators. As the legislatures and courts applied these changes to the law, they ignored thousands of years of history, literature, and painfully gained knowledge of human sexual behavior. Instead, our society's elite deferred to Kinsey and suddenly reclassified immoral sexual conduct as having no public health consequences. Judges and lawyers worship at the Kinsey Temple. Oh, our Lord Kinsey. That was a joke, sorry. As soon as the K-bomb hit the streets, penologists, legislators, and lawyers traveled regularly to Bloomington to worship at the feet of the great man. From him, lawyers, legislators, judges learned how to gut our laws, using what some knew and some did not know were his big lies. According to the Rockefeller Foundation's Alan Gregg, in 1950, Kinsey collaborated with law and justice professionals, reportedly meeting with about one well-qualified visitor a day. Penologists, sociologists, legislative experts, psychologists, doctors of medicine, lawyers, and directors of welfare and social work, ministers and teachers. In turn, Kinsey often received kudos for the lawyerly language in his two books. In fact, as noted, he plagiarized the legal verbiage of Judge Guyon and American Civil Liberties Union lawyer Morris Ernst. Thus, within a few years, Kinsey's pathological influence was visible throughout our legal culture and among all the professions that Gregg listed in 1950. In December 2006, Ed Hines, Vice President of Morality and Media, wrote in obscenitycrimes.org that the sexual revolution began with child abuse. Hines levels the charge that Kinsey and his staff separated morality from intimacy. It was the start of this so-called sexual revolution, an era of sexual license. The sexual revolution was based on Kinsey's claim that we are sexual from birth, a claim that emerged directly from sexual abuse on children and babies, producing innumerable negative developments in predatory crime, including a booming global trade in adult and child internet pornography. Sexual violence against women and children and international trafficking of 600 to 800,000 women and more children annually for prostitution, plus millions more trafficked, abused, raped, and murdered. Some revolution, concluded Mr. Haynes. Backed by the Rockefeller Foundation and others, Kinsey, a mad sexual psychopath, and his cult followers sabotaged every state legislator in the Union, gutted our laws, and revolutionized American sexual life to mirror their own perversions. So in the end, Kinsey's real crime was crime, though it was illegal before and after Kinsey reports. The seriousness of rape diminished drastically in the post-Kinsey years, as people began to believe that women might have contrived rape charges for devious reasons. Judges began ruling rape as over-enthusiastic sex and a victimless crime, giving legal standing later to rough sex as murder defense. The issue of statutory rape became pivotal, since Kinsey reports promoted children as sexual from birth. American law softened with regard to the sexuality of minors and eased laws protecting children, lowering the age of consent, fostering the view of adult sex with juveniles as victimless, and that was only the beginning. Kinsey changed the laws protecting women and children using the American Law Institute Model Penal Code. The American Institute's Model Penal Code, ALI-MPC. In 1948, attorney Louis B. Schwartz reviewed Kinsey's male volume in the University of Pennsylvania's Law Review for Bench and Bar, providing the new language that would legalize formally proscribed sexual conduct. Schwartz wrote, To reveal that certain behavior patterns are widespread, that they are a product of environment, opportunity, age, and other factors over the individual has little control, that they are not objectively harmful except as a respect of society's efforts at repression, to suggest that the law ought not to punish and that psychiatrists might better devote themselves to reassuring the sexual deviant rather than attention to redirect behavior. All these add up to denial that sexual perversion is an evil. Well, goodness. I want to take a 10-second break here and get something to drink. I still got some coffee, so I'm going to try to finish it out. The American Law Institute, the ALI, founded in 1923, joined the American Bar Association, ABA, in 1947, began the national program of containing education of the bar. In 1948, the Carnegie Foundation funded the ALI to educate, and in 1950, the Rockefeller Foundation stepped in to finance the ALI's new model penal code. By 1955, the ALI, Schwartz, as well as judges, lawyers, and a support cadre from psychiatry, created the New American Law Institute Model Penal Code, which relied heavily on Kinsey's sexual data. Immediately, the ABA adopted it, and the ALI used the code to train future lawyers, judges, and law school professors. State by state, the ALI-MPC altered our nation's sex crime statutes. According to Kinsey's authorized biographer, Jonathan Gathorn Hardy, the ALI-MPC was Kinsey's work, virtually a Kinsey document. True, 100% of the 1955 ALI-MPC's footnotes justifications for reducing or abolishing penalties for sex crimes quoted Kinsey as proof. Just because it's written in the book, it doesn't make it so. And just because a bunch of child molesters write on paper and signed it, that doesn't make it right either. The Kinsey Institute had to have loved it. The ALI-MPC pro-offered evidence to justify legalizing or, in the interim, liberalizing all of Kinsey Cabal's sexual perversions. The ALI-MPC deliberate systemic assault on the safety of women and children should be required reading for everyone who studies the law. This code was a Kinseyan change agent that caused a paradigm shift from the common law that arguably protected crime victims to Kinsey's bogus pseudoscientific law that clearly protected predators and blamed victims. Thus, the privileging of predators was a Kinsey Institute achievement with the support of our local institutions. Kinsey's prominence in the ALI model penal code was no coincidence. It was done deal because Kinsey's data justified elitist laws to end old-fashioned common laws, and they did. In 1955, the ALI-MPC soon reached all American legislators. Then it lightened or ended penalties for obscenity, adultery, prostitution, abortion, rape, sodomy, and child molestation, and so on. And the most predatory crimes changes would include contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Pre-Kinsey, illegal. Post-Kinsey, what was illegal in every state in the Union, adults described describing sexual conduct and showing sexual explicit pictures to children, based on sex education, became legal in schools and libraries, leading to the lightning penalties for similar conduct or the wider society as well. As Kinsey and Sexology's academy increasingly claimed sex with children was victimless, crimes against children increased. In 1999, the FBI cited 58,200 children kidnapped by non-family members and over 1 million throwaway and kidnapped by family members. Children became roughly 80% of reported rape crimes. Wow. Prostitution, pre-Kinsey, illegal. Post-Kinsey, sometimes legalized or privatized as a victimless crime. Kinsey claims that use of prostitution was widespread and harmless. He offered no reports of sexually transmitted diseases, illegitimacy, alcoholism, battery, or other negative consequences. This eased restraint of any punishment for prostitution. For example, sex therapy, surrogates, prostitutes are still legal in some states as a form of impotence treatment, further legitimizing sex for profit, a precursor to today's human sex traffic. In fact, in 2010, the widespread practice of child prostitution in Georgia has resulted in Senate Bill 304 to legalize child prostitution to protect children in a matter of speaking. Hence, prostituting one's children under age six could be legal in Georgia. Imagine the increase in Georgia's housing market. Clever. Rape, statutory rape, pre-Kinsey, illegal. Post-Kinsey, penalties reduced. Pre-Kinsey, premarital sex seriously decreased a woman's marriage opportunities and her legal credibility. So women's legal standing barely rested on her virginity. Therefore, rape was a serious crime. 18 states allowed the death penalty for rape. Most of the rest, life or long sentences. But in 1955, the ALI MPC said women and children were seldom raped, that they made up most charges. Judges began to rule rape over as over-enthusiastic sex, a victimless crime, giving legal standing later to rough sex as a murder defense. By 1958, for no recorded reason, the FBI excluded statutory rape and children under 12 from its uniform crime reports on rape crimes. Kinsey's data permeate all present thinking on this subject. Kinsey worked to revise sex laws with the Illinois, New Jersey, New York, Delaware, Wyoming, and Oregon sex commissions. In 1949, he testified before the California Subcommittee on Sex Crimes, claiming that his sex studies found that 95% of the male population has actually engaged in sexual activities, which are contrary to the law. A year later, a New Jersey report on sex deviation praised Kinsey. By 1951, explaining its own findings, the Illinois Sex Offender Commission acknowledged that the Kinsey findings permeate all present thinking on this subject. As unconscionable consequence of the ALI MPC has been the transfer of decision-making authority from judges and juries to sexperts, because Professor Herbert Welschler wrote in the 1952 Harvard Law Review, "Judges have no special expertise or insight that warrants giving them a decision voice. a decisive voice. In the determination of the treatment of offenders, he urged that judges should be superseded by the disposition board that would draw personnel from equal weight from social work, psychiatry, penology, and education. Moreover, juries were no longer permitted to hear all the evidence about the accused, lest it prejudice their view on his or her guilt. Yeah, let's just leave a bunch of evidence out because it might sway the jury. That's what that means, folks. Let's just leave this evidence out because somebody might think you're bad. Thus, Kinsey's influence on the ALI-MPC significantly curbed the uniquely American system, a jury of one's peers. I think I'll mark my spot right here. Take the first break. Get my marker. I need to finish off my coffee so I can make it through 2 hours here. Okay, let's see. I guess just a couple of short songs here. Be back in about 4.5 minutes, everyone. Well, about 5 minutes. Jesus, you're our man for the hour. Jesus, you're our man for the day. Keeping us together through your power. Oh, yeah. Jesus, take our hand. Wash our sins away. Jesus, lead us right and help us through. Lord, you know the wrong we all do. Direct our minds today. If you should leave us now, I know we'd lose our way. Jesus is a man for the hour. Jesus is a man for the day. Okay, and welcome back here. The second segment. Not going to be any guests today. It's just 2 hours of book reading. Nobody contacted me and said they had to have an hour. So I'm just reading a book. And so it was that the train had left the station, metaphorically stopping at every state in the Union to deliver Kinsey's sexual news to American lawmakers. Predictably, a toxic bias favoring predators came to dominate our laws. In 1948, penologists were already citing Kinsey to eliminate life imprisonment and the death penalty for rape. For example, in his 1948 essay on sex and the law, Judge Morris Plasko wrote that implicit sex activity is so widespread that 99% of the total population could be convicted of sex offenders. Convicted as sex offenders. Thus, he said, sexual misconduct was a non-problem, as prohibitions are inherently unenforceable, since the law attempts to forbid an activity which responds to a wide human need. Kinsey's black propaganda spread. Columbia University law professor Burl H. Levy declared that Kinsey's data reflected contemporary values. Like Kinsey, in his sexology article, Dr. Levy described rape as naturally and therefore easily forgotten by young victims. The new ALI MPC would soon abolish unrealistic rape and statutory rape in all 50 states. So Kinsey was certifiably mad sexual. So Kinsey, a certifiably mad sexual psychopath, advised state legislative committees on how to rewrite our laws based on his personal sexuality model. Follow me, he said. It'll be great. They did, and it was, for grooming sexual psychopaths. It has not been great for women and children. Wechsler said the purpose of the ALI MPC was to reduce crime from its high rate in 1952. On evidence, then, the ALI MPC is a total, absolute failure. Women and children are raped and battered over 100% more today. Since the ALI MPC have seen massive increases in violent crime, with rape jumping off the charts. All of this is thanks to the Kinsey cult, who mainstreamed their, she says, no, but she means yes, theory of human sexuality into our laws. That was the first time anyone, except for admitted rapists in courtrooms, had ever asserted that children who screamed, wept, fainted, and fought to get away from their rapists actually derived pleasure from the situation. Subsequently, Kinseyan sexperts repeated the claim that women cry rape so they can enjoy sex without feeling guilty. Propaganda sabotage legitimizes rape. The difference between rape and a good time depends on whether the girl's parents were awake when she finally came home. Alfred C. Kinsey. While men under the patriarchy gave male seducers criminal penalties, Hugh Hefner, by contrast, provided a seduction manual to Joe College in his 1954 Playboy issue on virginity, in which Playboy advised readers to attack the mind, not the body. After selecting a suitable subject, Hefner trained his college users in seduction over rape. Boys are bigger than girls, and some guys figure that that's all the advantage they need to make any seduction a success. Trouble is, that ain't seduction. You've got to win over the lady's mind first. The muscle method is too often confused with a dirty four-letter word spelled R-A-P-E. Such goings-on lead to long jail sentences. How good of Hef to advise his readers on how to avoid jail. Instead, he outlines various alternative approaches for seducing a young virgin. Release her inhibitions with alcohol, promise her anything, or use Kinsey to emphasize the intellectual rather than physical. Beyond the obvious encouragement to trick and seduce young virgins, such publishers are on record as fully aware that their readers come to view the pornographic fantasy world as their own possible reality. Starting with Hugh Hefner, Kinsey's cult picked up the baton as Playboy sought to conquer virginity and women with thousands of seduction, rape, and gang rape jokes, stories, and cartoons for American men, our future national leaders. After more than half a century of mainstream pornography, users are inured to normal. Marital sexual relations often rendered impotent. To be momentarily virile, they require increasingly energizing stimuli. Images of sex linked to hate, anger, shame, or violence in an endless cycle that encourages copycat crimes. I just realized we've gotten through 236 pages so far. So we're zipping right along here. I think somewhere in the vicinity of 340 pages. Somewhere in there, in that area. Almost about 103 pages left. Now, if I can find my spot again. After more than half a century of mainstreamed pornography, users are inured. Nope, I read that already. In a more recent justification of sexual violence, anthropologist Craig Palmer and biologist Randy Thornhill claimed in 2000 that rape is a natural biological phenomenon, a desire to reproduce, and a product of the human evolutionary heritage. With slipshod scholarship and execrable ethics, Palmer and Thornhill's logic ignored the massive increase in rapes of infantile infants, children, young boys, and older women, not to mention that overwhelming negative sociological effects of rape on any its recipients. Liberals also neglect to explain why rape, like homosexuality, if it is a natural biological phenomenon, increases and decreases with the era and culture. Were such conduct natural, like breathing, it should remain at the same level cross-culturally and over time. But rape rates, like sexual orientation, fluctuate depending on the belief system and the stimuli in the culture. When society, especially male leaders, sufficiently abhor and punish rape, and anything that supports it, rape decreases. When alpha males pardon rape, it increases. Utmost resistance and other prosecutorial impediments. Unaware that Kinsey's World War II criminals were their legal model, the ALI-MPC imposed new rules about rape and gang rape. If defendant's lawyers accused a victim of a racy past, they could label her a prostitute. And if lawyers said a foolish young girl engaged in casual sex or drinking, she would be blamed for her own rape, reported David Bryden in the Buffalo Criminal Law Review. In 1961, Burl Levy snidely asked, "What is rape?" He remarked in 1961 that courts must recognize the utmost resistance theory. It must be shown that a woman fought back like a tiger, resisting with all her might and main and with every means at her disposal, punching, scratching, biting, kicking, screaming, etc. Some experts have expressed the opinion that it is well high impossible for a man to rape a woman of ordinary good health and strength. Really? That's a joke. An absolute joke. Feminist lawyer Susan Estrich added that forcible rapes are graded if serious bodily harm injury is inflicted. Forcible rape is a first-degree felony, she said. But what is serious bodily harm? Is not rape itself serious bodily harm? Estrich observed that homosexual rape, sodomy, is ever seen as a lesser felony. In her famous 1986 Yale Law Review article, Rape, Estrich expressed her confusion that the ALI-MPC's rape innovations, which perplexed her. She was not alone. Juries were so confused that they often acted more leniently than they intended. Estrich was irate. The more liberated society got, the more men raped women and then children, and the lighter their punishments. Why did her liberal male colleagues, judges, lawyers, and her friends treat rape more casually than did traditional, unliberated, patriarchal American men? Kinsey's black propaganda was so successful that under the 1980 ALI-MPC, unlike other crimes, rape and sexual assault require corroboration or a fresh complaint of the victim's testimony. Even if the victim met this requirement, the new ALI-MPC ordered juries to hear cautionary instructions about the victim's possible tainted history and testimony. Then liberal courts demanded extensive corroboration of the nation's testimony and the proof of her chastity. So under the new MPC, judges gave her wide leeway to rapists and lawyers to portray victims as promiscuous and presumably willing participants. The Kinseyans also shortened the statutes of limitations. Pre-Kinsey, 33% of states had no statute limitations on rape, reports. The sex lobby promptly reversed this. In 2000, Iowa law set a 3-year statute of limitations on most rape cases, 5 years if the victim was a minor. New York's statute became 5 years, extending 5 more if the victim did not know the predator. In 2005, Florida, Nevada, and New Jersey were on record at 5 years, with longer time frames due largely to the development of the efficient DNA evidence, which could convict the predators. Kinsey cultists liberate rape penalties. Pre-Kinsey American men often shared President Theodore Roosevelt's view on rape, as he expressed it in his sixth annual message to Congress in 1906. Rape, he believed, was the most horrific of all crimes because even murder was usually a male-on-male battle, commonly acted out on someone on an even playing field. But rape preys on women unable to protect themselves. Current university, liberal, male, and institutional feminist dogma insists that there were more rapes pre-Kinsey under the patriarchy. They argue that women made fewer reports because of the draconian culture. to an extent, that could be true. To a certain extent, but I'm sure, well back 120 years ago, a lot of women didn't report rapes just like they don't today, for some reason. But this argument is illogical, given the tough rape laws that enabled rape victims to come forward. In 1780, rape, right up there with murder, sodomy, burglary, robbery, arson, and treason against the Commonwealth was aggressively prosecuted. According to Massachusetts court laws, court records, 1698 to 1797, the rape peaked in 1725-1734 at 3.5 rapes per 100,000 population. Moreover, during those 99 years, the all-male jury tended to believe rape charges and punish predators accordingly. By 2008, Massachusetts rape is recorded at 25.6 per 100,000. This is a 550% rape increase, and the latter data excluded the rapes of children under the age 12. We've come a long way, but is this where we want to be? The millions of adults and child rape victims are a legacy of the Kinsey's Institute Sexual Revolution. With the first Kinsey report, Judge Morris Plasko argued that lightening sex crime penalties, he reported in the 1948 penalties for rape. Trying to read this graph here, pre-Kinsey ALIMPC USA, 1948 rape penalties. 19 states had the death or life. 27 states had 20 plus years. One state had 15 years. In practice, convicted rapists often got jail and public horsewhipping. Unlike the post-Kinsey restrictions on victims, women could report rape whenever they felt ready, and cases could be prosecuted regardless of any statute of limitations. Even by the early 1950s, a third of our states had no statute limitations for rape reports. As a result, most rape-minded men tempered their lust because of draconian laws and the wrath of legal penalties imposed by other men. Rape laws upheld colonial restrictions such that where a man had sex with an unmarried girl or woman, he was viewed as a villain. In Alabama, for example, men who committed rape were stricken from the voting records. When or if they emerged from prison, such severe pre-Kinsey penalties protected women and children. No more. Whittling away at prosecutions against rape. The new 1980 MPC changed America's rape laws dramatically, citing a few of the several thousand university law review journals, and affirmatively cite the Kinsey reports. Professor Linda Jeffrey, PhD, and Colonel Ronald Ray, retired, summarized the sabotage of sex crime laws that legalize all sex by consenting adults, condemned judicial bias against sex offenders, reduced sex crime penalties, reviewed boy prostitution as trivial, rejected common law Judeo-Christian standards of virtue, honor, and chastity, legalized homosexuality, provided beneficent concern for pedophiles, reduced sex law penalties, claimed that young children are seducers, argued that we must legalize all prostitution, rehabilitating sexual predators and letting them go. The original ALI-MPC wrote that a majority of authorities find that the sex offender in general is not a recidivist. Defying all common sense and knowledge, this preposterous scientific degree emerged. Come on. These pages are terrible. Hard to turn. Defying all common sense and knowledge, this preposterous scientific degree emerged from the Kinsey-based California Sex Crimes Report, 1950-1953. Since Kinsey claimed that 95% of the male population has actually engaged in sexual activities, which are contrary to the law, he urged parole for all rapists, even murderers. Kinsey urged lessening the penalty. Why? Well, others grant parole immediately in 80% of sex cases. Kinsey disciple John Gagnon bragged that educated people nationwide were echoing Kinsey's theories. A more modest and less violent image of the sex offender began to appear in the public press. Rather than focusing on rare violent events, attention began to be paid to the majority of people whose offenses were occasional, who had no criminal past, and who were responsive to treatment. Alrighty, I think another break right here. The second break. So let me see here. Gotta find my mouse first. I guess about a 6 minute song. 6 minute 11 seconds. We'll be right back.
Lost in sin, but Jesus took me in. Thank you.
and my tears. My eyes may be filled with many tears. Oh, Jesus is my friend.
Okay, and welcome back, everyone. I like the Gaither Gospel Group. They really get into the songs, that's for sure. And welcome back to the second hour of Cats and Look Ball on Shake and Wake Radio. And still going to continue. I wonder if Lucas showed up. I told him I was going on air about 20 minutes before 4. I don't know if he's in here or not. If he is, he hasn't said anything. He's been lurking in the background. I don't know. I haven't seen him either. But Gang Nun never, nor anyone else, possessed or discovered it, a treatment that worked on sexual predators, ever. Still, he claimed, hang on a second here. Still, he claimed, with an increase in public sexual knowledge, new ways of thinking about the relationship between sex and law began to emerge. Pivotal to these concepts that the distinction between victim and victimless sex in the 1950s. Crediting Kinsey for researching into unconventional sex, Gagnon said Kinsey's work led to current views that most sex offenders were not sex fiends, and few were violent or dangerous or likely to repeat their crimes. Yeah, whatever. I did forget to say that please help the stations out if you're able to with donations. It would be greatly appreciated. Adding bad logic to Kinsey's bad data, sex reoffenders argued that we cannot prosecute 1% of men for sex acts that are common to 95% of all men. We must either arrest all men or pardon the 1% and punishment and provide therapy. Of course, this makes no distinction that with regard to the severity of those sex acts. For example, before Kinsey, America's penal codes, based on common law, defined sex crimes as both offenses against persons and crimes against morals. In their argument that 95% of men broke sex laws, the sexologists make no distinction between crimes against morals, says public cursing. The predatory crime, rape and murder, no matter in books and publicity brochures, Kinsey and sexperts regularly perpetuate the low recidivism myth discussed in more detail shortly. This fraud created revolving doors for sex predators who go into short-term prisons, sentences, and treatment, and out to commit new rapes and even murders. Authorities soon wanted therapy for predators so they could learn to control their urges. Bear in mind that therapy for sex offenders is costly. A 2009 National Institute of Justice conference noted probation for preferable as jail to jail. It's about $78 a day per prisoner and about $3.42 a day for somebody on probation. In 1993, the U.S. Senate passed a National Crime Victims Right Week. So I suppose we can account as moral progress that once a year we recognize new victims of violent sex crimes with ceremonies and such like. Similarly, in 1996, President Bill Clinton and Senator Howard Heflin, Democrat Alabama, proposed the U.S. Constitution add a Victims' Rights Amendment to give rights to victims. So instead of imposing severe penalties, capital punishment, or life without parole for violent crimes, or even requiring a legal memorandum, a legal moratorium on media glorification of rape and murder, we resolved to honor victims' rights. As of this writing, however, few states inform rape victims whether their rapist has AIDS or other communicable diseases. In Florida, a rape victim who was denied her rapist medical records due to privacy considerations asked, "Why does he have any privacy rights? He certainly disregarded mine." One of the victim's rights measures was to include the right to be notified of a parole hearing, the right to speak or present written testimony, the right to be notified of the release of the criminal, and the right to restitution from the defendant. But why do courts parole these violent criminals in the first place? Following Kinsey's World War II data, that rape was the natural and normal reaction to any available female, victims often had fewer rights than their attackers. So are legal institutions allowed and continue to allow Kinseyan focus on rehabilitation and parole for rapists and murderers, so these violent predators could continue to victimize? As unpleasant as it is, life imprisonment or the death penalty are the only guarantees of the rights of victims. The result: a rape victim every 45 seconds. What if women really enjoy rape? What if the public accepted the idea that women wanted hot sex but were too restrained by society to admit it? She says no, but she really means yes. If this is true, wouldn't the public consider rape harmless, natural, and biological? And shouldn't we change our laws to accommodate this view? If we did change our laws to give this implicit permission on behalf of women, what would happen? Of course, the rape rate would increase. And of course, that's exactly what has happened. Year after year, decade after decade, since 1955, the ALI MPC, heralding the toxic fallout of Kinsey's liberated sexuality, the nation adopted the behavior of a sexual psychopath, Kinsey, and nationalized sexual psychopathology. In 1940, Look magazine reported that there were about 100 murders per year in Harlem, but rape is very rare. Then, on the heels of the Kinsey's 1948-1953 books, New York saw a major change in the view of women and children, sex and crime. In 1965, some 2,320 forcible rapes were reported in New York. By 1985, there were 5,706. Then rapes of women and children eclipsed men's murders on men, a major shift in aggressive focus. The authors of Transforming a Rape Culture asked, "Do rape and sexual assault truly permeate this society, or are we hearing about the sensationalized, isolated cases? Has the rate of sexual violence really increased?" In 1996, sexologist Peggy Sanday and A Woman Scorned reported on national 20-year rape increases per capita. Between 1935 and 1956, arrest rates for rape nearly doubled, as did the rates for other sexual offenses. Sanday noted that a tragic loss of unbelievability for women came with sexual license, a legal version of the "she meant yes" phenomena. Given the judicial indifference toward rape victims, Washington, D.C. saw the first rape crisis center as a small group of women organized to offset the increasingly tolerant judicial system. Now hundreds of centers offer a broad spectrum of services to sexual assault victims because the centers do not require the victims to make police reports. These centers reduce the number of rapes, including in the FBI Uniform Crime Report. In 1999, an analysis, Rape in America, by the U.S. Department of Justice and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, reported on interviews with 8,000 women and 8,000 men. They found that 1 in 6 women experienced an attempted rape or a completed rape. More than half, 54%, were minors at the time, and 22% were under age 12. In the same study, 1 in 33 men reported that they had experienced a sexual assault. Other research finds 1 in 6 men reported sexual assault. Boys aged 12 to 17 were found to be 2 to 3 times more likely to be sexually assaulted than adults. Other DOJ data identified 64% of forcible sodomy victims as boys aged 12. Crime steadily escalated from the 1960s onward, and the rape far outstripped all other violent crimes. According to the violent crime data from the FBI Index of Crime, United States 1960 to 1999, the population grew 52% in 39 years, 1960 to 1999. At the same time, violent crime grew 396%. Rape raised the average, increasing 418%. New York City Justice Morris Plasko wrote that during the 30s, only 418 crimes of forcible rape were reported in New York City, averaging 35 per year. By 2004, the city recorded 1,740 forcible rapes. So while the New York City population grew roughly 16% from 1930 to 2000, its reported rape rate grew 4,871%. And that is not just better reporting. Of course, Plasko's 1930 rape data included statutory rape, removed from the FBI Uniform Crime Code in 1957 and 1958. So this data therefore counted all female victims, including those under 12 years of age. Today, though, rape data reported to the public does not include rapes of children under age 12. From 1950 to 2004, based on the body count, the DOJ identified a shocking 19.6% increase in homicide nationwide, with 16,137 homicides reported in 2004. Remember, due to modern medical and emergency services that were not available decades ago, homicide rates are significantly lower than they would have been in the 1950 medicine. Absent similar physical proof of rape, 94,635 forcible rapes were reported in 2004, with 20% estimated as forcible rapes. Even using this data, the DOJ data found forcible rape by men in 2004 was roughly 540% higher than homicide commonly by men, a 5-to-32 ratio. In 2007, the American Medical Association cited sexual assault, often unreported and unrecognized, as a silent, violent epidemic, and the most rapidly growing violent crimes in America, claiming a victim every 45 seconds. Finally, the racial side of this epidemic. derives attention, indeed. White pornography has devastated the black community, the black family, and, of course, the honor due to black women and children. Moreover, according to a recent task force, Native women are victimized at rates higher than any other population in the United States. It is estimated that in their lifetime, 1 in 3 Native women will be raped, and 6 of 10 will be physically assaulted. Despite the statistics, questions remain about their veracity. One moment, the FBI announces that rape was disappearing. 14 months later, they announced that the purported respite was over. Rape numbers were heading up. A couple of years later, in 2004, the FBI said violent crime was down again, though one category of violence was up, rape. They reported 1 in 4% increase and rapes in 2003, which had increased over 2002. By 2006, though, some law professors were charging that the FBI data had been reflected. The FBI data again reflected a radical reduction in rape, this time by a fantastic 85%. Citing the Washington Post report that the number of rapes per capita in the United States has plunged by more than 85% since the 1970s, even though other violent offenses increased, according to the federal crime data. Wow, good news. Kinsey and lawyers touted that nationwide porn was up and rape was down. They cheered. But the FBI United States crime rates, 1960 to 2005, data listed not an 85% decrease, but an 8.6% increase. The Kinsey and liberals were speechless. This report also showed that, forcible rape had increased 230.2% from 1960 to 2008. Frankly, for rape statistics to be down at all, lying statistics have to be up. In fact, a 2000 U.S. News and World Report article reported that facing political heat to cut crime in the city, investigators in New York Police Department's sex crime unit sat on thousands of reports of rape and other sexual assaults. A police commander said the way crime was solved was with an eraser. In one district, police failed to report between 13,000 and 37,000 major crimes. A 2000 Philadelphia Inquirer report found that from 1997 to 1999, of 300,000 sex crime reports, officials had downgraded thousands of rapes to investigation of persons, or investigation, protection, and medical examination codes for non-crimes. This put 1 in 4 rapes in a non-crime category. Debbie Goldberg reported in 1998 Washington Post article that the crime-fighting method favored the Philadelphia Police Department was reducing crimes. It's been an accepted practice over a long period of time, said a 25-year Philadelphia police veteran who spoke on condition and anonymity. There's pressure to keep crime statistics down, and captains are held responsible for what goes on in their district. Date rape skyrockets. Today's college co-eds, who must arm themselves with mace and rape whistles when they walk to the campus library, believe they have more freedom than any young woman in history. But pre-Kinsey College girls didn't need rape crisis centers or rape whistles, and parents did not fear sending their precious lambs to any American college or university. In past generations, men were expected to carry out nubile, errant, young drinker to her bed, remove her shoes, cover her gently, and leave her unmolested. Young men did so. Times change. Current rates of co-ed sexual assault cites roughly 25% of the college women. Despite the controversy about the rate of rape, the fact that most colleges now supply rape whistles to their co-eds does suggest a change in college courtesies from pre-Kinsey days. Joe College no longer saves himself or his bride, with everyone encouraged to drink to excess and hook up. Rape is identified as the most common violent crime in U.S. college campuses today. This is reported rape. Most rape goes unreported. College women are more at risk for rape and other form of sexual assault than women the same age but not in college. It is estimated that almost 25% of women who have been victims of rape or attempted rape. Most respected colleges have become sexual war zones. The Harvard University Police Department reported that 52 sexual offenses on the Cambridge campus were reported to the police in 2004, and 61 Harvard students sought assistance from the Office of Sexual Assault Prevention and Response after experiencing a rape or sexual assault. Although they suppressed findings of pornography's central role in rape, college administrators do admit that alcohol and drugs, including the date rape drugs, feed this culture. So did Kinsey. Kinsey directly counseled states' law committees to destigmatize all sex acts that society previously had understood to be pathological, social, harmful, and some said even sinful. The Kinsey-Guyon legal theory held that only marks of violence and vehement physical resistance proved rape had occurred. Victims seduced, once illegal, a felony in California, enticed, tricked, or drugged into sexual predator or a gang of predators, were no longer viewed as rape victims. And increasingly, in the hookup culture, victims are collaborators. Even if authorities charged and convicted such a predator, punishment would likely be drastically reduced or even set aside. This philosophy even showed up, especially in states of legal theory on what became commonly called date rape. This new defense had defendants arguing that the victim should have known sex was part of the date. Kinsey's image of promiscuous females became a reality as boyfriends, professors, and feminists encouraged girls to be modern and cool with alcohol, drugs, and sex. All right, I'll take the last break right here. I think I will put my dinner on. I'll put a bit of a long song on so I can put my dinner on in the oven and have enough time. So be back in about 8.5 minutes, everyone. Whoops.
This has been an awesome night, isn't it, everyone? This one. How many of you like Negro spirituals? An old black lady down south showed me something about the Negro spirituals, and I want to share it with you. You know, the black folk down south had more sense by accident than some of us have on purpose. You know what I mean? You didn't hear what I said. I heard an old black lady say, "Son, if the mountain was smooth, you couldn't climb it." Think about that for a minute. But did you know, she said to me, "Did you know all, just about all Negro spirituals are written on the black notes of the piano?" This is absolutely true. You can go home tonight and play almost any Negro spiritual, just play the black notes on the piano. You look skeptical. Now, you can't see it out there, but I want you to watch. Watch. There are five black notes on the piano. And those same five black notes just keep recurring. And you can go home tonight and play almost any Negro spiritual, just play the black notes. Watch. You know that? Every time I feel the spirit, just black notes. Watch this. That's because the slaves didn't come to America with do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. That's somebody else's scale, okay? All they had in their musical scale were those five black notes. We know it in music as the pentatonic scale. And they built the power and pathos of the Negro spiritual on five notes. When you study music, you also come across what are known as white spirituals. Did you know that? And they are white composers who work with those that scale. In early America, they used to call this the slave scale. And I'm going to play for you what some musicologists think is the most famous white spiritual built on the slave scale or just the black notes. Song? I heard it, a man by the name of John Newton. But do you know what John Newton did before he became a Christian? He was the captain of a slave ship. And many believe heard this melody that sounds very much like a West African sorrow chant and wrote the words Amazing Grace and set his words to a slave melody. I looked up that song. I believe God wanted that song written just the way it was written, just so that we would be reminded that as Christians, whether black or white, free or bond, in his eyes, we're all connected. We are connected. And we are connected by God's amazing grace. Hallelujah! We are connected by God's amazing grace. I looked up that song in the Library of Congress. I went to the Library of Congress. I looked up that song. And wherever you see it authentically printed, you know what it says? Words, John Newton. Melody, unknown. I tell the Lord, when I get to heaven, I want to meet Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but boy, I want to meet that slave called unknown. And I recorded that song the way I hear it. When I sing it, I still hear the sounds of the slave ships in the water. I want to sing it for you the way John Newton probably first heard it, coming up out of the belly of the ship.
Okay. I guess we're going to go about 20 more minutes here. I put some chicken in the oven there for to bake it. It'll take about an hour, so I'll be done and ready for dinner after the show. No, I don't want to trade you any. I don't want anything to do with Florida weather. I've been down there. It's too hot. Too hot for me. Michigan is too hot for me in the summer. So I don't want any of it. Anyways. College co-eds were secretly drugged at parties, then raped while unconscious. Often they were labeled racy. With new rules about sex, girls who had been gang raped by athletes or fraternity members regularly and humiliatingly lost in court, leaving the college to struggle with the emotional aftermath of the physical assaults, the self-blame, and the humiliation. Not so far the rapists who generally remained on campus, graduating untainted. Department of Justice statistics confirm that the presence of sexual sabotage and the absence of justice in rape cases. Among all women who were raped since age 18, only 7.8% said their rapist was criminally prosecuted. 3.3% said their rapist was convicted of a crime, and a mere 2.2% of said their rapist was incarcerated. 13% of women who were raped since age 18 said they obtained a restraining order against their rapist. Of these women, 65.9% said their rapist violated the order. In fraternities and the rape culture, Chris O'Sullivan reported that fraternity houses often display pornographic pictures and magazines, and the members eagerly watch pornographic films and videos. Some frat brothers engage in sex with a young female student during whom the boys consider unattractive as part of a pig or hog contest. After the act, they discard the naive victim. The girl is often a staple for ongoing frat humor, as the men often video record the event for posterity. One woman reported fraternity brothers actively plotting to get five first-year girls drunk and rape them, and sorority sisters actively plotting to have other women taken advantage of tag rape. Millions of girls pay the high price for the Rockefeller-funded Kinsey and Black propaganda that Hugh Hefner mainstreamed. For most, absent broken bones, black eyes, and inappropriate blood, vaginal blood, would not occur, would not count. There was no crime. Culture of implicit consent. What happens when fraternity gang rapists graduate? They become our professors, social workers, doctors, research scientists, filmmakers, executives, bureaucrats, reporters, penologists, teachers, judges, and lawyers, and even very powerful politicians and legislators. They become predators in power, like President Bill Clinton. High education, wealth, and prestige do not protect against predatory intent. Remember Nobel Prize winner Charlton Gajdusek, PhD, American University President Richard Berenstain, PhD, American University Psychology Department Head Bill McGinnis, PhD, and the University of Southern California's father of gene therapy, William Anderson, MD, all have been arrested and pedophile pederast-associated felonies. Such high-profile trials will not escape some mass media attention. But if the predators are homosexual, the gay lobby will immediately launch damage control. For decades, Kinsey supporters and the ALI MPC blamed the victim, until an army of largely female lawyers, many of whom, like Susan Estrich, had been raped, began forcing legal change. The need to corroborate rape was allegedly abolished. As I touched on earlier, rape shield laws now often protect the victim's sexual history. Judges may no longer instruct juries to remember that the victim might be lying. And victims now have more time before they must report a rape to the police. However, these are largely empty victories. Rape convictions are typically plea bargained down to misdemeanors. At a cost of billions of tax dollars and immeasurable heartbreak, pandemic rape of women and children reigns unchecked. We try to educate our school children to make them responsible for protecting themselves. Adults in our society have abdicated their responsibility to secure tough penalties and a clean media, to protect the most vulnerable of us. Clean media. Yeah, she actually said that. Leading us to sexploitation. Leading us into sexploitation. Grinning, well, demonically, Alfred Kinsey loved these films and often watched and showed them, said his biographer, Gathorne Hardy. Kinsey leers as several young children are forced to watch a violent, scatological, porcupine mating film. Consider their deeply troubled expressions as Gathorne Hardy described the film. Yes, it is. That's a good one, Annie. The foreplay standing on hind legs, the male pressing the female down, at which she dramatically and completely opened up all her quills, and the male descended over her, entering with a number of rapid strokes, jackknifing over her to suck his penis clean and relaxed. Six adults are in the room with Kinsey, Clara, and Cornelia Christensen. On the far right, look excited. The other adults look distressed. A dark-haired girl on the far right gasps as the boy at right frontly is clearly traumatized. Prostitution and sex trafficking. As divorced mothers sought new partners to father their children, child neglect and sexual abuse increased. Physical and sexual abuse of children, including child murder, is especially linked to the mothers, boyfriends, and new husbands. When divorce skyrocketed, children were in a no-win situation. Whether their mother stayed with or left a violent husband, children got beaten and too often suffered sexual assault. Daughters of batterers are 6.5 times more likely than other girls to become victims of father-daughter incest. When our scientists jettisoned God, as Voltaire warned, with him went the ideas of sin and guilt. Men no longer condemned the man who jumped the wife of his young for a trophy wife. Dumped the wife of his youth for a trophy wife. Few men no longer ostracize sexually exploitative male colleagues. And more men mistreated women, girls, and boys. Kinsey's effect on the sexual abuse of children was profound and far-reaching. Kinsey gloated, and he commonly asked a girl how old she was when she turned her first trick. Although Kinsey interviewed a huge prostitution population, he hid the data in all prostituted women. He certainly hid the data on the age of initial prostitution. The Kinsey Institute, in its reprint of Kinsey's key data, reiterates his fraudulent male findings. 69% of white males have had at least one experience with a prostitute. That is a joke, even today. Among unmarried males, sex with prostitute was about 10% of the total premarital intercourse. That's an absolute joke. 69% of white males have had at least one experience with a prostitute. During World War II, the Kinsey team interviewed hundreds, if not thousands, of prostitutes and spent a massive amount of time discussing men's use of prostitutes. Yet in their tomes, alleging to report all the vital data on sexual behavior of men and women, the team centered all the information on the origins or consequences of prostitution. In doing so, they made it another victimless crime. In 2008, Edwin Schur's 1963 book, Narcotic Addiction in Britain and America, first published by the infamous Tavistock London, was republished. In 1965, the influential sociologist and lawyer wrote one of a series in his far-left books on gender, Deviance, the Family, the Sexual Revolution, and Crime. This earth-shaking treatise he called Crimes Without Victims. Here, Schur quotes Kinsey more than any other sexpert to explain that abortion, homosexuality, and drug abuse are consensual, therefore harmless, and should be legal. This argument is used to justify legalizing prostitution as well as pornography, polygamy, incest between adults, and all manner of social crimes. Scores of social scientists and criminologists followed Schur, citing him and calling his legitimization of any alleged consensual vice as without victims. But the public, the unorganized polity, began to organize to counter the crippling influence of these educated elitists, noticing that there were secondary victims to consensual adultery, the betrayed spouse and children, to drug use, and even sodomy, venereal diseases, dead unborn babies, abandoned and impoverished single mothers, prostitution, diseases, and even community blight. Since prostitutes raided no Kinsey data, neither did their drug and alcohol abuse. Prostitutes, by definition, are the most sexually active persons. They are also major drug and alcohol addicts with high rates of abortions and illegitimate babies. Both male and female prostitutes have commonly endured early sexual abuse and or incest and suffered STDs, battery, homicide, and suicide. Kinsey obviously did not want to know that early sexual abuse is a chief cause of girls and boys entering prostitution, with high rates, 65-90%, of incest among girls, according to the Council of Prostitution Alternatives in Portland, Oregon. Their 1991 annual report found that 85% of their prostitute clients reported history of sexual abuse in childhood, 70% reported incest. Homosexual academician Donald West's study of English males prostitutes confirmed early sexual abuse. Incest was less common. West viewed sex abuse in childhood as a cause of male prostitution and said the perpetrators are nearly always men. However, Characteristically, West insisted that the abused, violated, and betrayed boys were innately gay, and so they largely consented to their continued abuse. Despite this justification, West still admitted the brutality, both prostituted, and he calls some gay males, gay male lifestyles. What I just read here reminded me of a video I listened to before, about a half hour before I come on air. It was a rapper I'd never heard of. I don't remember his name now, but he was talking about some other big shot rap producer. Don't remember his name now either. But he was talking about being molested as a boy, and he knew it was wrong the first time he got molested, but he still kept going back because he admired the man so much. He said he was like a father figure to him because his father wasn't in the picture anymore. His mother divorced him, and he had a broken home, and he still kept going back, although he said he wasn't gay then, and he's still not gay now, and he has children and a wife. So I don't know about some of this stuff. It's kind of weird to me. Kinsey carefully ignored and discarded any such data among his specimens, data that obviously did not further his agenda. While he dispassionately examined prostitutes as scientific specimens like the gall wasp he nailed to little bits of cardboard, he cherry-picked the information that suited his agenda. Yes, Mom, it is. But he did finally come out and publicly say that the man was raping him as a boy. But so many black men don't. Black boys don't. Or just so many boys don't, period. Sexual freedom advocates Barry Benjamin, M.D., and R.E.L. Masters showed somewhat more compassion in describing the horrors of prostitution, citing extensively from Kinsey's secret interviews with prostitutes. They trivialized prostitutes, drug and alcohol use, and vigorously hid all data on homosexual abuse of boys, and then boldly called for legitimizing prostitution as an outlet for men. Yet they did describe what Kinsey team knew from interviews with prostitutes. An unknown number of the drug addicts are murdered by pushers by means of an overdose of heroin or narcotics laced with strychnine or some other lethal poison. According to addicts, such murders are numerous. Legitimizing prostitution, normalizing incest. As is clear from the effort by Georgia legislators in 2010, important sexually disordered people are always seeking to legitimize prostitution of women and children. Kinsey, like most legislation advocates, ignored such murders in the trade, censoring them from his reports. While he specialized in collecting stories from prostitutes in poverty-ridden urban areas and bragging about measuring their clitorises for science, he hid what he knew about their tragic lives. Clearly, he had contempt for the suffering of the victimless prostitution as he sought legalization of prostitution as a job. Touring Italy in 1955, Kinsey was oblivious to the post-war poverty and suffering around him. So obsessed was he with prostitution, namely the child sex traffic. Like most pederasts, Kinsey viewed the boy prostitutes as handsome young Italian boys who, victimless, he argued, were engaged in sex for pleasure. Well, I think I'll mark my spot right here for the day. And say thanks everyone for coming out. And I guess just a short... Nah, I won't even have a song. Andy, you can put a song on to end. So thanks everyone. And hope everyone comes out tomorrow for me and Roger. Until next time.